Hey everyone, my name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs. I pride myself on showing up on time, on doing research. I wasn't on time for today's guest, 16 minutes late. Got Jeff Epstein back here. He's an entrepreneur I interviewed about 4 years ago about his company, Ambassador. It's all-in-one referral software. Jeff, before I do like the proper intro and tell people about the sponsors, I got to tell you why I'm late. My stomach, like right here, I don't know if you can see it, it's killing me, the upper part of my stomach. I'm constantly like late for stuff today and constantly under the gun. It's not late. I mean, it was like a 10 or so minute lateness. I don't want to make too much of it. We texted each other so you were aware of it. But I just keep like, I think I'm overcommitted. I'm taking on way too much stuff. I can't say no to people because I care about my customers. I care about my audience. I care about the people in our whole world. And I feel like, well, I know I could help this person in 15 minutes. Why don't I just do a 50? It's just a 15 minute call. And so I schedule just a 15 minute call. And I remember working, this is kind of a little bit taken away from your interview, but I want to talk to you about this because I didn't realize that you were going through stuff. Frankly, I told you, I thought that you were 23 years old when we talked, and I thought that you had the world by the tail. And it's not until I saw the pre-interview notes that I realized, man, Ambassador actually had some challenges. I had no idea. But I remember when I was a kid, my dad at one point opened up a store, sneaker store, then another, and then I think another. And he didn't relate to the customers. He was a guy who was born in Iran. His first language was Persian. He's speaking to people who's like, who aren't even speaking English. They're speaking hip hop. And they want like a cool buying experience. And he's just like, Farsi Medune. Right. And so, anyway, so he didn't get them. I always said, I want to find an audience. I want to find a customer base that I get, that I love, because I felt like he missed that. And I do. And now it's making it harder. Do you relate to any of this?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think for, you know, went through much of the same, you know, challenges in terms of, in looking back at my last interview, before I was turning a product into a somewhat of a company. Now it's turning a company into a scalable business
with
people, right? And that's completely different. And thinking about how I have to act and how it relates to them is it's everything, and it's completely different. So it's really interesting.
Almost like in the beginning you're trying to figure out what you are, and then you're trying to figure out how to be that. In the beginning, I was trying to figure out what is Mixergy? What is this collection of products that we're doing? And now it's, how do I do it right? How do I, you know, show up in enough for our customers, for our audience and so on, but not some way that's counterproductive? How do I show up for my team enough that I'm actually there for them, but not so much that I'm micromanaging, you know? And it's how do you, and I feel like that's where you are right now too, or that's where you've been since our last interview.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the biggest changes for me was, again, growing and scaling a team. You know, in the beginning, I kind of called it was a culture by osmosis. Like people did what I was doing. They just emulated me, and it makes sense. And then you get departments and teams and, you know, maybe multiple offices, and all of a sudden the communication is just very different. And the things that work when you are a table or two tables doesn't work when you're 20 or 30 people. And that's a huge challenge that I always heard people talk about culture and how important it was and communication, all those things. And you kind of just assume, oh, those are the other problem companies that are talking about those things.
And we don't have that culture problem because we have a product and we know what we're doing. And you know what? Let me say to the audience, this interview is sponsored by two companies I'll tell you more about later. The first is Pipedrive, will help you sell more. And actually, I remember you told me about Aaron's book last time. You were really into the sales process. We'll talk about how Pipedrive works with the sales process that you've used. And the second is TopTal for hiring great developers. I'll tell you guys more about both of those, TopTal.com. I'll tell you more about both those later. Jeff, why don't we catch people up? The business, I gave the one sentence description. Can you give me a use case of Ambassador?
Yeah. So great use case. So what we do is help companies with their relationships. So we view the world as kind of four different relationships that companies use now to drive customer acquisition. One is referral, customer referral. If you think about the Uber Dropbox model, Hulu is a great example. They're one of our customers. We also have a more traditional affiliate model, partner programs, and also influencer marketing.
So basically, if I'm using Hulu as a customer and they say refer a friend and you get, what do you get?
I think in their case, it may be $10 or something.
$10. Like. So if I see, hey, refer a friend to Hulu and you'll get 10 bucks. Whenever my brother signs up to Hulu, I'll get 10 bucks. It's Ambassador that's running that?
Yeah, it's our technology that's inside of their application, actually. So okay. You won't know it's us, but we're powering the entire experience from the front end that people see, and then also the back end in terms of the reward fulfillment and the analytics and data and database for them.
Okay, and it's also if I wanted to create an affiliate program and say, hey, everyone, we sell chatbots, and if you want to sell a chatbot on our behalf and make a commission from every chatbot sold, you can do it, and it's Ambassador that we might use to power that referral affiliate program.
Exactly. And for us, the way that we see the world is all of those types of relationships, those are the differences, right? The relationships, the attribution, the tracking, it's all pretty similar. So we can power all those. It's the use case and positioning from a company perspective that's really different. So we're B2B SaaS. We work with hundreds of companies across multiple verticals. And last time we talked, we were next to an auto body shop, you know, in a small cold garage, basically. And now we're about 40 people, you know, in 7,000 square feet, you know, millions of revenue per year. You know, a lot has changed over the course of 4 years.
You weren't really comfortable with me giving out your exact revenue last time. I hinted enough at it to give people, I just wanted them to get a sense of scale and where you were. Can I say what it was roughly back then?
I think, yeah, we I think it was close to a million, I think.
Annual. Close to a million, and we're talking about the year 2013. And now we're recording this at the end of 2017 to give people a sense. Where are you guys now with revenue?
Yeah, so we'll be in between 5 and 10 million is kind of the number that we're, okay. You know. So, it's not the very low end, but it's not at 10. So we basically 5 to 10x the business kind of across the board since we spoke. We've raised a little bit of money as well, less than $3 million, so a small amount for startup.
No, because you really need it. Let me ask you this, though. Before I get into what's happened since then, and I want to spend a lot of time on culture and employees and the things that you need to do to get to where you are, I got to ask you, Hulu, smart freaking company, great engineers at Hulu, they can't just create a refer friend, get $10 program? Why can't they just do it themselves? Why do they need to sign up for Ambassador?
Yeah, so the thing that we see with every company is, and again, this is a software in general, right? Like you can build anything. The key isn't maybe building the MVP. It's maintaining, managing, you know, staying with and optimizing if you build something in-house.
Like what's an optimization that they might not know that they need to do that you do?
So even we have, for example, you know, we're constantly iterating both from the technology, from a tracking perspective, in terms of the making things happen more quickly in terms of looking for various use cases where there may be issues in certain browsers and click bots and all the things that you're not thinking about in terms of executing the program. But if your analytics are off because there are different, you know, new things that are happening in the latest version of Chrome, like that's the last thing your team wants to think about.
I see. They want to think about how do we make this video work in the next version of Chrome, not how do we make our affiliate $10 referral thing work. I see.
Exactly.
And frankly, you guys had issues with that at one point too, right?
With what exactly?
With incompatibility, and you ended up bringing in an outside testing firm.
Yeah, so we work with a company that does a great job with testing, and it wasn't necessarily a problem. It was just for us. It was, you know, I think there's an inflection point in every business, and you realize this now that I'm doing this at a different level, where you really. There's so much value in just focusing on what you do best and then outsourcing everything else. And again, it's something that I always heard people say, and I kind of didn't believe it. And then you experience it. So for us, QA isn't, we don't want to have a core competency in QA. We pride ourselves in having as few bugs as possible with our process, but the actual tedious work of QAing is painful. So we actually work with a company called Rainforest QA. They do a great job. They've been doing that for a couple of years. We spend time basically setting up tests, and then they have people that actually do it every hour. They're running tests. So it's a pretty expensive program platform, for example, but it saves us a couple full-time engineers who would be doing that. And it makes it a lot easier for our customers.
Let me bring up the problem so that people don't think that you're just like looking for parts of your business that you shouldn't specialize in and start passing it on. As I understand it from your conversation with our producer, you guys were hitting some growing pains here, hitting a few limits in the app where Ambassador was so successful it would break the app at times. We never tested what it would be like to have a million people. We only tested what's it like to use this software when we have 20,000, 100,000 people, and then we suddenly got to a million people and it did not work. Well, that might be okay when we're just getting started, but when we have clients like Hulu, no way. We got to be 100% bulletproof. And that is why you said, we shouldn't do this ourselves. Let's bring in an outside team that does it. The test. Yeah. Exactly. I feel like I'm making you uncomfortable with that, with this whole topic. You're shifting in your seat. Are you okay?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, I apologize. So you were late, but I like rescheduled and I had a couple board. I had a board meeting and I did the interview
a while back.
So I was just trying to remember what the context of what I was saying, but yeah, I mean, for us, it was, you know, I think as we moved up market, and one of the big changes for us is we started working with more and more enterprise brands, and the scale of what they wanted to do was just so much greater. And you know, we were, a couple of years ago, if a company had 1,000 ambassadors, so to speak, that was a pretty large company, you know, relative to the others in our, you know, in our client list. Now we have many of them that are multiple million customer, you know, ambassadors system, and the scale is completely different. The challenges that we're thinking about to serve them are very different from a compliance perspective, from an information security perspective, things that we didn't think about when we were in the garage. Now we have to do those. Otherwise we have no chance of being successful.
Can you give me an example of the kind of test that you might send out to them? Because I'll be honest with you, I did interviews with a couple of different QA companies, and I remember walking into the interview saying, this is a business? People can't just test their product themselves. And it was explained to me, and I fully get it now, where you want to test in multiple countries, you want to test on multiple devices, you want someone who's going to test and not just say something didn't work, but specifically, no, this didn't work because I did this other thing. What a couple of tests that you do? I want to learn about this space a little bit more.
Right. So I think what's challenging is, so even though we have about, you know, 300 or 400 customers, we actually have hundreds of millions of end users. So we're not just working for the customers. We're actually serving the hundreds of millions of people who interact with our technology. And so the problems or the potential problems are really endless in the various, you know, types of, if you're making a matrix, right? So the things that we do is we just have these testers go through dozens and dozens of scenarios. So it's open this thing with this browser, with this device. And that alone probably is 50 different tests. And then every time we make something new, it's adding in that new thing. So it's sharing, clicking on a page, clicking on a, we have portals. So there's all these different things and all these interactions. And it's a series of like 50 or 60 steps. And then it's across multiple devices, right? So it's like all these things happening at once. And anytime we push code maybe a dozen times a day. So every time we push code, there's a new series of tests going off.
How do you add to the list? What's the process? Is it based on customer service issues so that you say from now on, let's add this test because a few people have had this problem?
So, and to be honest, and which is interesting is I actually don't know the entire process. I can give you kind of a sense of how it's, you know, how I think we do it. But I'm not actually personally involved with making the test. But what we do is we have, obviously senior engineers, we have junior engineers, we have director of engineering, and we have CTO. And basically our director of engineering primarily handles kind of the scope of the various tests that we write. We have our own tests in our code. Those are different than someone who is actually doing QA. But the QA test, we basically give them directions and they say, follow these steps. If you see, for example, if this thing happens, you know, it's a check mark. If this thing happens, check mark. And so they go through these check marks. Director of engineering will set that up. Set it up and change it and as needed. And then they'll check the boxes for us.
All right. Last interview we did, 2013, you guys were at about 10 people in the company. It was mostly engineers, but you and two other people did everything that was non-tech. You mentioned HR, support, sales, the works. In the interview at the time, I asked you, what's one book that you would recommend to entrepreneurs? And you said, you know what? The one that I'm really enjoying right now is Predictable Revenue. Predictable Revenue is the book by Aaron Ross that tells you how to set up your sales process and your sales team. You're smiling. Tell me how you used it to set up your sales team, because you were at the time setting that up and now it's scaled up.
Yeah. So It's funny because I think sales is always a challenge. And at first you need to be able to learn how to sell yourself. And I would say even back then, I probably wasn't very good at it. And until you are capable of actually closing a couple deals or several dozens of deals, it's really hard to tell somebody else how to sell your baby. So how we've done it, I mean, I think, you know, one of the people that I admire and I think does a great job is Jason Lumpkin Saster. I think thankfully that blog, you know, I wish that blog was around earlier. It would have saved me a lot of hassle. But I got lucky and I hired a VP of sales who actually knew how to, what he calls building the machine, knew how to build the machine. And we really worked closely together. I kind of gave him knowledge, my knowledge on the product and the market. And he went ahead and kind of said, this is what it needs to look like. Let's build this out. So he's done a great job. I've been fortunate. Most people go through lots of VP of sales. I've only hired one, and he's still here today. And he's done a great job, and that really has been super beneficial from a sales perspective.
Can you tell me what that machine looks like? Help me understand what a sales machine looks like in an organization like yours.
Yeah. So there's a couple components. One is first and foremost understanding. So his name is Zach. Zach came in, learned how to sell, was on calls with me, on demos with me, and said, This is what we need. This is the kind of person we need. Then what we did is we created what he calls a talk track and a clip track, right? So what you're saying and then also what you're doing when you're saying it. And then it was, what are the kinds of people we can hire to most effectively do these? So it was really starting with the basics, understanding what it took to close the deal, and then what are the kind of people that can be effective in those roles. So we were fortunate, we had three people when I hired him that were customer facing. Myself, one, and the two others did both sales and support, which is a horrible idea. I learned my lesson. Like, context switching is really hard.
Yeah.
One of them ended up being full-time sales and is actually our top sales rep. And the other one went to full-time success and is now like our head of what we call a strategic account. So it works with the biggest companies that we work with. So luckily we had that kind of initial. So,
let me see if I understand this. Talk track, click track, and people is what you mentioned. Before we get into this, take me through the flow from stranger to customer. So a stranger comes in, would they come into a blog post, to your website, through a conference, an expo? Where would they come in?
Yeah, so about 75% of our customers come in on the website somehow. So they're from, and most of it is either, it's, you know, paid, or they find us through search. Obviously, search is a huge part of it. Paid ads, they schedule a demo on our website. So the first entry point is typically a form fill. They say what they, you know, are interested in, leave some information. We reach out, contact them, set up a demo. That's kind of the first step.
And I see it on your website, on the homepage. One of the big two buttons is chat with us. If I fill that out, the form that comes up after I hit that button, I'm going to schedule a call with someone on your team. When you say the click track and talk track, that means that that person will do a screen share with me and talk me through how to use the software. And so your VP of sales created what the salesperson will tell me about and what they'll show me to teach me about this product. Am I right?
Exactly. And you know, we're in a position, and I think our category is, it's still emerging. You know, I think there's a lot of different use cases. There's definitely different ways companies sell into referrals or affiliate. But really, a lot of what we're doing is educating marketers. Most people come to us with, this makes a lot of sense, but we're not doing it yet. Or we're doing it in our heads or in Excel, but we're not replacing an existing platform. So what we found is it requires actually a little bit more education and more examples of showing people what actually you need to do.
Okay.
Opposed to just saying, oh, we're solving this one problem for you.
Okay. All right. And actually, you know what? I'm on the homepage now. I must have seen one of your A/B tests, because the test that I see right now doesn't say chat with us. It says schedule a demo. And that's the main thing. There's a Wistia video, and headline that says meet the world's number one all-in-one referral software. And then the big button that says schedule a demo. Okay. That makes sense. So after the call, what's the next step after that?
So it varies. I mean, for most companies, the stages that we think about after the first call, you know, we consider if the company is engaged, if they're looking to move forward, if it makes sense for them, obviously qualifying them during that process as well. The next step is typically what we call tech spec. So once we talk to the company, it seems to make sense for them. We say, what is it going to take to integrate, you know, bring some of the folks to the table, from a technical perspective on your side that need to be involved. We will not always necessarily need to bring anybody else, but sometimes we will if it makes sense. And so we'll have that discussion. So first is really, is this something that makes sense for you guys from a marketing perspective, from a business perspective? Second is, how are we going to execute, you know, in reality? Okay. Depending on the company needs, that varies. Like, some companies can get up and running in a matter of a few minutes in terms of getting code, JavaScript on their website. Other large enterprises, there are, you know, InfoSec requirements. There are various dev cycles and schedules and all these other things that we have to think about, API calls, all those things that we'll map out with them throughout this process.
Okay. What about one of the things that I'm learning about more and more lately is SDR, sales development reps. Do you guys use those?
So we do, although we don't have a ton of them. So I mean, I've seen some companies that are really SDR heavy, and we've never really crossed that.
What do they do at your company?
So for us, they're basically what we call outbound. So they're outbound prospectors. They generate lists. They find various people that would be interesting and fit a certain segment or demographic of customer that have been successful, and then they'll start emailing them and calling them in various sequences.
Okay.
Their goal is obviously they're graded on essentially booking appointments and ultimately dollars attributed to, you know, closed deals.
So they get paid based on number of appointments and dollars that those appointments lead to.
Correct. Part, I mean, they obviously have salary, but that's kind of the commission structure.
Okay, I see. All right. What specifically from predictable revenue did you implement that has been especially helpful?
So, I mean, some of the things we did was just being consistent. Like, you know, I think predictable revenue for me, and again, this was several years ago, but what really worked well for us was, I think, just creating a consistent process that can scale. And I think, again, when I was basically doing everything, everything lived in my head. I knew all the customers. I could adapt my sales style for each call. That's not really a scalable way to do things. And when I was trying to explain this to our VP of sales, I would say, hey, we just need to, you know, think about it this way. And if they answer this, then go in this direction. And he's like, that doesn't work. Like, you have to build a process. And I think what predictable revenue, among many lessons, was you build a scalable process that works, and you fine tune it over time, but you continue to do that and create a way to consistently generate leads and new businesses and new demos. And in the end of the day, it becomes math.
And then you can keep improving it because you can see the results. You can give people new click and talk tracks. I see. Okay. Exactly. All right. Let me take a moment to talk about my sponsor. And then I want to come back and ask you about what's that background, which I really like. I'm glad that you did it. And also talk about the people who will go into this whole sales process. So the sponsor is a company called Pipedrive. We actually teach people how to create chatbots at this sister company that I have called Bot Academy. And I want our audience to hire, if they're going to hire someone to build a chatbot, it should be one of our graduates. And for a while there, what we were doing was kind of half-assing it. We just say, hey, if you need a chatbot, contact us. Someone would contact us, and then someone on the team would say, hey, you know what? I think I know the right person to talk to. Go talk to them, or go to this form and buy. And it was just like you said, just no process. Just come on, of course, why do we need a process? Someone's telling us they need a bot. We should just go and talk to them. And obviously it became maddening. So I hired someone and I said, look, the first thing I want you to do is think of what you think the steps will probably be to close a sale. It's not going to be send them to a page and have them buy, because they want experience. They want to talk to someone before spending thousands of dollars on a chatbot. I said, lay it out. So she did. She went to Pipedrive and she created columns, one column for each step in our sales process. Step number one, fill out a form, ask to talk to us. Step number two, schedule a call, etc. And what I did just before you and I talked was I talked to the person on our team who set this process up. And I said, okay, I see that you set it up, but here's what I want you to do. If someone fills out a form and they're not a good fit, don't just email them and tell them they're not a good fit. I want you to drag their card from the column that's column number one to the lost column. And in Pipedrive, when you drag it to lost, it doesn't just say, okay, that's it, we're going to get rid of the person. It says, tell me why. So now she could say, this person's business is too small, or this person doesn't have a business yet. That's why she's rejecting them nicely, but she's rejecting them. What that allows us to do is go back to our form that people use to request a conversation with us and say, if someone fills this in and says in the drop-down menu, I have no business, or I've never bought an ad, they're not a good fit for us. And what we should say instead is immediately fire off an email that says, you know, we want to only work with people who we know we can service. We don't want to take your money just because you're offering it to us. What you should do instead is just go and learn from these free resources. So now we have a process. She can go and fill that out. I looked at her steps, the different steps that she's taking. Some of them are really good. Some I think are a mistake. And I told her, let's get rid of that step. It's a distraction. Another step that I added that she didn't think to add was during a call, I want her to record the call since we're just getting started. And after the call, I added another step to her process to send the transcript to a transcription service because I'm not going to spend half hour listening to her call, but I will read it and tell her how she's doing. And that's super helpful. And then we'll also create this database of calls that anyone else can go and learn from. All right. The reason that we're this organized is because we use Pipe Drive. If you're out there listening to me and you sell one-on-one, you really need to organize yourself and your sales process. What Pipe Drive does is it forces you to organize it. It says, create the columns, one column for each step. Now start moving people along. It tells you when someone drops off, you have to tell us why they dropped off so you can learn from it. So then you have, at the end of the month, you have a list of all the reasons why people are not buying from you. It also gives you stats. How many people got into the system this week? How many did you close? Who's closing the most? All that stuff happens naturally behind the scenes. I like PipeDrive because I set it up and they just force me to stay consistent. This is what we use to build our sales machines for everything that we sell. If you want to check it out, don't go to pipedrive.com like everyone else on the internet. Go to the special URL called pipedrive.com/mixergy, where they're going to give you 14 days. Within 14 days, you can probably make a few sales and get a sense of how good this is. I see you're nodding your head, Jeff. You're right, right? Good salesperson, 14 days, plenty. And it forces you, knowing that that deadline of free time is going to end in 14 days, to use it and to close your sales. If you're happy with it, 25% off for the next 3 months thereafter. Believe me, these guys have such low prices. I think they're actually undercharging for it. So this 25% discount is not going to make or break for you. What is going to make or break for you is using the software. Go check them out at pipedrive.com/mixergy. pipedrive.com/mixergy. Okay, let's talk about the people on the team. Actually, you know what? You mentioned raising money. You told our producer that was a thing that you didn't think that you'd really needed. Mm-hmm. You did raise a little bit. You went through Techstars, right? Back in, when was this? Roughly 2012?
Yeah, 2011. End of 2011, yeah.
2011, okay. So you went through Techstars. They funded you a little bit. They gave you some support. At the time, they were only doing like 25,000 or so per founder. What was it that made you realize, hey, we actually have to, even though we're generating revenue, we have to raise more money?
Yeah. And again, it was one of those things where, you know, I really prided myself on being really capital efficient. I would say we still are today, but it was a situation where we were comfortable kind of just making enough to pay the bills and not really investing too heavily in anything. And I didn't actually run a process. We had raised up until that point, and we formally raised in 2013. In 2015. We had raised about $400,000. So a pretty small amount of money. It was coming in $50,000 chunks, give or take. I put my own money in, and it wasn't taking a very big salary. But in 2015, we got some interest from an investor, and I just really loved their philosophy. They're based in Fargo, North Dakota, or South Dakota. They're Midwest. You know, they really just were fans of companies that, you know, were kind of in their mind doing things in a way that was more sustainable opposed to just going all in or bust. And so for me, it just really resonated, and we ended up taking money and partnering with Arthur Ventures, which is a great fund. They're in a lot of great B2B SaaS companies in the Midwest and some on the East Coast as well. And so that kind of set off a chain of events where you can invest ahead. And for me, that was, hey, maybe Jeff should be doing everything. Let's hire a team of experienced folks who can build out their teams, and you can do things more efficiently and really specialize in various departments like sales, of course.
You weren't comfortable really raising money because you still had a little bit of money in the bank. Your attitude was, hey, you know what? Things are working well. We don't need funding. Was there like a catastrophe? Was there something? Were you missing opportunities? I feel like there was some kind of pain that forced you to say, hey, Jeff, you're this one kind of person. You got to shift to be this other kind of person, the kind of person who goes and raises money. Talk to me about that inner struggle. Like, what was it that got you there?
So I think it was a few things. One was, I've always wanted to build a sustainable business. That was really important to me. And I didn't want to over leverage the business to the point where if I screwed up, we would fail and lay people off. And some people, and I think maybe even the best entrepreneurs, are okay with that risk for other people, right? They're willing to put everything on the line, and it's all or nothing. It's 100x or 1000x or nothing. for me, that isn't my goal. And I would be honest, when I was talking to investors, I'd love to be a $1 billion company, but if we're 100 million, I'm not going to be horrified about that. Right. Mm-hmm. And I also, I don't want to go through dozens and dozens and dozens of employees if we're doing things wrong. Like, to me, it matters. Like, building a startup in the Midwest is very different than the Valley. And I think this is where, for me, it makes a big difference. You know, people there know it's, hey, we're going to do what we can. We're going to put our work in. We're going to accrue our, we're going to vest our stock, and then we're going to go on. Here, most people don't even understand the idea of getting stock. It's very different here. Great, talented people. So for me, the struggle was, I don't want to leverage the business for maybe an outcome that is only a little bit better, marginally better. And I think, looking back, that was not a smart move. I should have probably raised capital a bit earlier and invested in more better people quickly.
Do you feel like now you have to get to the $1 billion status to justify the funding?
No, I mean, I think if we would have continued to go, we would have put ourselves in a tough position. Again, pointing back to a Jason Lumpkin blog post, he says skip around, and I think we definitely skipped around. I think
what's skip around mean?
It means, in order to get to where you need to be, you assume that you raise money every 12 to 18 months. Mm-hmm. And let's say to get to a IPO, assuming you do everything right, it may be 6 or 7 rounds of financing. And then if you're 1 or 2 founders, you end up with a couple percentage points, that's it, of the business, right? And there's plenty of blog posts.
So skip a round of funding, you end up with a bigger share of the business, a little bit more pain, but it's not such a bad thing. And that's what you did. You might've skipped 2 rounds.
Exactly. And for me, it was also about being able to control our destiny more, right? I mean, I think every time you raise money, you lose control over how you operate the business. Like, the bets you have to make with the capital you receive are material bets. If you're wrong, a department might get cut, right? I mean, we're seeing large public companies or companies that are on the IPO track that are laying off massive departments. It's not necessarily say that's right or wrong, but for me, that wasn't something that I was interested in doing this early on, was making a big bet and then cutting 20 people that kind of bet on us. And again, I think that's where it's a little bit different.
Let me say this. You've mentioned it a couple of times. We have to give this URL clearly to people. You have to go check it out. Saastr, SAASTR.com. Jason Lemkin is a guy who, he's just found his spot. Yes, he invests in companies, but it's just a handful that really fit his criteria. You want SaaS companies that are sales-based, that have a certain number, right? And because he's that focused, everything he teaches is that focused. You know what? I had no idea. He actually has co-working space not too far from here. Actually, I was working in his building, and then I went to lunch and I saw someone who was working in his co-working space. So I went inside. It's nothing but guys who do sales calls. That's his focus. He has co-working, but even his co-working isn't just any guy off the street can come in here with an idea. It's bring your sales teams in here. This is what we're about, sales. Now, he is someone who says when he invests in a company, he can help. He wants the kind of company that he can bring in a senior VP of sales, that he can help structure the sales department. You didn't have that. How did you find? I'm looking at the person that you hired. This is Zach Taylor.
Yep.
He ran, and I guess still kind of runs, a company called Tailwind Sales, which teaches sales. How did you run into him? How'd you end up working with him?
It's a funny story. So Zach actually found me. This Tailwind Sales was a consulting side thing that he was doing. And he actually reached out to me and said, I've heard about your product in the market. This is, 2013 or 2014. It's really interesting. I've heard great things. I think you need my help, which was literally his line.
So good.
And so I was like, well, this is good timing. He actually lives in Cincinnati. He drove in, we met in person, we talked, we said, and this could make sense. We talked again. We said, let's try it for a couple months, help me build the machine. And then a month or so into the agreement, we said, hey, let's do something long-term. This makes a lot of sense. And we really like each other, and we think this can be successful. So it was originally a consulting project. It was me almost not really committing to bring somebody in. And again, I didn't have enough money to do that. It was for a senior sales hire was probably more than half the company was getting paid combined, right? It was a material decision. So that really started the chain of events in terms of, hey, let's think about really putting some gasoline in this. Let's raise money. Let's hire salespeople and really hire some more senior people who can take the load off of Jeff. Because ultimately, I'd never done this before. My sales experience was, you know, hitting my head against the wall and just picking myself back up hundreds of times. But it certainly wasn't necessarily the right way to do things. And, you know, there's a lot more resources out there today that I think I could have read to be a little bit more, further along. But, you know, Zach, the year that Zach started, we raised money, we 3X the business.
So just 3X the business.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, and part of it is setting up that machine. So it's a structured sales process that then can be improved and measured and hire the right people to run the process. We're going to get into the people in a moment, but here's something that I'm noticing. So on my main screen, I have a screenshot of what your pricing page looked like back when we first talked. And on the right screen, I have what your pricing page looks like now. Back then, your cheapest pricing was $99 a month. Your most expensive was $1,500 a month. Now your cheapest is $800, from $100 to $800. You've increased the prices also. Now you ask for annual billing versus back then, everything says monthly, monthly, monthly. Yeah. Tell me about pricing, how you adjusted it, and how you figured out what the right pricing model was.
Sure. And pricing is one of the toughest things. I would say maybe the toughest thing especially when you're still learning about the market. And for us, it was a matter of a little bit of unit economics and seeing which companies were successful. So because there's a lot of education involved, as I mentioned, both in the sales process, but also in the actual onboarding and usage of our platform, we wanted to commit as much time and energy as we could to make people successful. And we knew that in our case, it meant putting people in the process, walking them through, teaching them, coaching them. So we have what we call an implementation manager, implementation coach. We also have a success coach. Those people are included with every customer we work with.
So the implementation, just make sure that anyone who signs up for your software actually uses it. The success manager makes sure that they're actually seeing some real measurable results in their business, because if they don't use it, they're going to drop out and not pay. If they do sign up and they use it and they don't get results, they're going to be disappointed again, leave, and you don't want that. I see. So that's why you have two different roles.
Exactly. So we have them and obviously everybody else who's supporting it. And for us, it was just, we found that the companies that were successful tended to have the various characteristics that, you know, that fit and were able to pay, you know, $10,000 a year for marketing software. And that's certainly not for everyone. And for us, you know, we had a finite amount of time and resources, and now those were the people we wanted to go to. So just like in your example of if a company wasn't ready, you wanted to filter them into close loss, we're trying to have companies self-select, knowing that it's $800 a month, $10,000 a year, I'm still interested in a demo. Because those are the people that have been more successful over the course of the last few years, who have not only stayed customers, which is great for us, but also have seen great results for themselves, which is more important even than staying with us. So as we, you know, continue to grow and optimize our sales process, we've continued to move up some of our pricing to reflect the best customers who have all of these things figured out and are, again, what I would consider investing in customer acquisition at a high level. Not necessarily experimenting.
You know, now I'm going back to the Zferral days. That's the previous name of the company. To 2010, the pricing back then started at $50 a month. But it's more that I'm seeing on that. And I knew you back when, or at least I knew the product back when it was Zferral. And Zferral went after smaller sites, like really... You were going after the guys who were affiliates, almost professional affiliates. And what's interesting to me about you is, as I go through all these screenshots and notes that I've had over the years about you, is you keep leveling up who you go after too. And I wonder if there's a mindset shift where the person who I see here who created this early website with Robert Scoble, I think is a quote on the site, isn't the same person who today can say Hulu is our client, we're going to take great care of them. Did you have to go through a mindset change where you say, this is who I am? Talk a little bit about that. I see you're nodding.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it's the evolution of, you know, for me, it was really the evolution of being a founder or CEO. In a lot of ways, I mean, you can self-appoint yourself CEO, but you really, in all intents and purposes, you're not, right? Like, I mean, I founded the company, like, all that meant was I spent $50 to create an LLC, and I decided that I wasn't going to take any money from anybody else. But that was really all I did. So, you know, I think you don't know what you don't know. And that's, it's really, it allows you to go really far, but it's also incredibly dangerous. And for me, the mind shift was, you know, I think having a lot of doubt, which I think many entrepreneurs do, it's extreme highs and extreme lows, and you get kicked in the teeth over and over again, and you don't really know, is this something that I can actually accomplish?
When was the time when you didn't think that? Because I told you before we started that you always seemed like you had it together. You always seemed like you were the 22-year-old kid who just figured it out and things were working out. Do you remember a time? Why don't I give you a moment to think about it and also give the audience something to look forward to after the ad? If there's a time that you remember when things just weren't going right for you, where you almost lost it personally, lost confidence, lost the business, lost anything. Let me take a moment, though, while you're thinking about that and tell everyone about a company called TopTal. Have you ever heard or worked with TopTal, by the way?
I've heard of them. Yeah, yeah. We don't work with them, but I know they have a good reputation for sure.
They're starting to get more and more of a reputation. The reason is these guys started out very quietly. They were kind of like digital nomads, the two founders living, I think one of them was in South America, just like working on this idea, which is, what if we just get all the best developers out there to take a test? We really make it hard for them to pass this test so that they feel super proud to be a part of whatever it is that we create. And then when they do pass this test, we put them in our network so that when businesses want to hire the best of the best developers, they could come to us and they could hire the best of the best from us. And that's what TopTal did many years ago. Their founders came on here. Actually, one of their founders came on here to do an interview. The other founder is super secretive. I've known him for years. Tasso even came to one of the early Mixergy events. Super secretive. I don't even know if I'm allowed to say his name is Tasso. Is that secretive? He's like, we have a process here. We have the best of the best. No one can even know our test questions. And you know what? It works. I read this Medium post by someone who took the TopTal test. He failed, and he did this blog post analyzing himself of why he failed the TopTal test. And he said, look, things were going great. I really was on track here. And then I took my head off of this test because I had some client work, and I went and I did the client work instead of thinking about the test. And I can't wait to do the test again. So I sent that Medium post to Tasso. And you know what Tasso said? Nothing. Tasso is not willing to commit anything to documentation. He doesn't want to go on the record as supporting this kind of attitude, being against this kind of attitude. But that's the machine that these guys built. Phenomenal developers. So if anyone out there is looking for a developer and you want this kind of hard driving, people who push themselves to do good work, I urge you to go check out toptal.com/mixergy. As an aside, I did hire a developer from them. I did hire a designer from them. I recently also hired a profitability advisor. They now also do this business part of their offering. And I got someone who worked at McKinsey for a long time, who then went on to head a couple of Carlyle-backed groups. And now he's in retirement now. And I said, I need someone to do profitability. I said, how about him? I hired him. Before this guy even started, he analyzed my business. I did a screen share with him where I showed him my financials. Jeff, this guy, so he's looking, and I go, do you want the mouse? Because you're asking a lot of questions. He goes, yeah, give me mouse control and zoom. So I gave him mouse control and zoom, started just skimming around. He goes, I think this, you need to do this. I think you need to do that. I said, great. I like this. I took a moment. I didn't want to say you're hired on the call. I wanted to think about it. And then I thought about it 2 days later. I said, you're hired. He was supposed to start on Monday. The weekend before, without even being paid, he put together a spreadsheet telling me why I was wrong to put together an LLC for my company. You mentioned you started as an LLC. It said S Corp. Did you switch to an S Corp?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Do you remember why you switched?
So for us, it was because we raised money. But in
right.
When you're losing money, it's better to be an LLC, especially because then it's a pass-through. When you're making money, there's different things that you could probably write off differently. And that's reasons. Yeah.
So he put together a spreadsheet because he knew that if he told me like that I don't know him, that I wouldn't trust him like I trust Jeff. So he put together a spreadsheet saying, here's exactly how much money you're going to make. Are you kidding me? He said. So, and then I said, why did my accountant do it? And he goes, yeah, accountants actually don't have an interest in pushing limits the way that I'm going to tell you to push limits. I'm going to push you and let them be the brakes in this relationship. And the point I'm making is, this is the kind of people that these guys at TopTal attract. A guy who, in his off time, can't help but not just tell me I'm doing things wrong, but put together a spreadsheet to the penny, and he's estimating. And on our call, when the day that he started, I show him my real numbers. He goes, I got that number a little bit off. I knew that's where it was going to be, but I got a little bit off, and here's how I do. Anyway, guys, if you're looking for this kind of person, TopTal is the place to go. Go check them out at this special URL where Mixergy listeners will get 80 hours of TopTal developer credit when they pay for their first 80 hours, in addition to a no-risk trial period of up to 2 weeks. I'm still in a no-risk trial period of up to 2 weeks with this guy, but he's been doing phenomenal. If you want all that, go check him out at toptal.com/Mixergy, toptal.com/Mixergy. It's just a pleasure, by the way, to be surrounded by people who are that good, who love their work that much. Don't you think, Jeff?
That's amazing. Yeah, no, that's the holy grail, right? I mean, I think that's what everyone's searching for, to create environments where you can attract those people, but also to find them. Absolutely.
I kind of feel like, I don't know Zach Taylor, your VP of, what is his title? VP of sales. But I kind of feel like he's the kind of person who would read a book on sales in his spare time, for example.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that we talk about is lifelong learners. And those are the people that are the most successful in our company. It's they're curious. They read. One of the books that I've been telling people about, which I know you're not asking, but I'll tell you anyways, because I've been putting on people as principles, Ray Dalio. It's unbelievable.
What's it about?
Principle. Yeah. So it talks about the way that he kind of organized his company, and really decision-making based on hundreds of principles that he developed over time. And it's really what I would consider like a framework for decision-making that's both, I think, very consistent, but also, really a really interesting way of thinking about really process in life and
he owns principles.com for anyone who wants to see this book. It's published by Simon & Schuster, but he owns principles.com. According to the website, Ray Dalio, one of the world's most successful investors and entrepreneurs, shares the unconventional principles that helped him create unique results in life and business, and which any person or organization can adopt to better achieve their goals. Dalio's original principles has been downloaded over 3 million times, and this expanded and revised edition is the first version available in print. And this is like life principles, work principles. Okay. Is there one part of this that's helped shape your life?
So I think for me, one of the things that I really focused on in the past year or two, and when I know one of the things we covered was creating a culture that was where people wanted to be and where I wanted to be, you know? And I think one of the challenges as you grow is you realize that there are dozens of people with dozens of assumptions and communicating with them all differently and the way that you do things. And you don't always create an environment where people are as happy as you think that they are, or as they should be, right? And as you want them to be. And so for me, it was a really big eye opener. And it happened when you get to about 20, 25 people. And it's like, we needed to codify all these things that I just took for granted. You know, it wasn't the way, you know, the way that we feel about people isn't obvious always. You know, the way that we want people to act isn't always obvious. And because of that, you see these little fractures in kind of the foundation that eventually become, you know, cracks or problems. And so for me, what I find so amazing is he obviously lived through this and created these principles and codified them so well and created this organization where you can hire, fire, promote, and make every business decision or even life decision based on these principles. And I think it's amazing. What I personally admire about it is it creates a ton of consistency, which I think is really valuable in terms of, you know, when you're in any relationship, being consistent, knowing what you're going to get, you know, that's incredibly important as well.
I'm trying to buy it now as we're talking, but I'll wait till after I'm on the phone grabbing it. You mentioned, that one of the challenges is assumptions, and frustrations sometimes happen when you misunderstand people's assumptions. I'm going to refer back to my pre-interview notes that you had, but not because I'm testing you. Hey, do you remember what was in the pre-interview notes? I'll tell you why. So that you know that what you've told us is actually getting absorbed by the organization and is influencing the interview. And so the audience knows, hey, look, behind the scenes here is not just a dude here with a mic, but a research team and a curiosity and an audience that's helping us make these interviews better and better. So going back to the notes, let me give people an example of a miscommunication that led to a problem. There was someone on your team who had a death in the family. The manager, you know, said, why don't you go home? Now, this kind of thing seems like the nice, right thing to do. Turns out the employee actually wanted to stay, wanted to keep his mind busy. And people for months had this miscommunication or misunderstanding about it. Am I right?
Yeah. And it was actually a really big deal. No one knew about it, which is the crazy part. So people thought we made this person stay in the office. I actually didn't even know it took place. what happened was someone several months later told me, yeah, one of the big reasons why I'm really frustrated is because of this situation where you made this person stay when they were clearly so visibly upset. And I was like, oh my gosh, like we would never, first of all, I knew we would never do that. We've had other similar situations where we handle it differently. And it was, it was crazy. And to me, it was just like a sad moment of, man, there's so much stuff that happens that I have no knowledge about. Right. And like, how do we do a better job of communicating across the company up and down to make sure that we're doing things and we're consistent in the way that we think about problems, we think about people, and not, you know, not being clear about that, not being as transparent. It's painful and it causes problems. And that's unfortunate because no one wants those.
Yeah. And no one's going to come up to you and say, hey, Jeff, why did you make that person work? It's kind of an awkward thing to do.
Right.
So these things end up just living under the surface, causing problems. How do you deal with this? How do you deal with people in general? It seems like you have something called OutCare. Does that help with that? Culture? Does that help? How do you do it?
Yeah. So one of the things we did, we recodified everything. So we basically created a term OutCare, right? It's not a real word. And it stands for, you know, own it, understand why, think long-term, choose camaraderie, always customer obsessed, raise the bar and execute with urgency. So that is OutCare.
That's what you guys stand for.
Yes, exactly. And so with the notion of OutCare, those are our principles, so to speak. We expect everybody to uphold those values every minute of the day. Ideally, I mean, obviously that's not always going to happen, but that's kind of the goal that we're setting for people. And we made it very clear. We reinforce that across our stand-ups every day, across, you know, posters in the office and in emails we send out. And it's something that I realize is we really need to codify this and we need to make decisions based on these values. And again, this isn't anything new, but one of the things that I think is truly important is making sure that people do understand why we make various decisions. And instead of just saying, do this, it's, we want to make sure that they understand why they're doing this so that they can, you know, add to it, make it better, give us feedback, continue to improve as an organization, as individuals as well.
Jeff, let me ask you this question that's really, it's going to sound naive, but I think it's important to question everything. Let's take the sales process. You have a machine. People know exactly what each part of the process is. They know what they need to do. And you guys can keep improving this machine. Why do you need culture if the machine just works? Can't you just say, look, you know what you need to do. You see month to month, our numbers are improving. Quit doubting it. Go with the machine. Keep building the machine. If you have a system, why do you need culture is what I'm asking.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I think it's a great question because I think in many cases that I would say founders also think that. And I was probably one of them. I just assumed, hey, we have a ping pong table. Like we have snacks, we have, you know, fun things, like people love it. But I think what you realize is culture is really the way that you treat customers, the way you treat, treat individuals on the team, the way you treat people when they're not looking, right? So how our teams interact with each other. So, you know, for me, it's important that, yes, like sales, you know, has a machine and they have to do things a certain way, right? Engineering has a culture and they do things a certain way. But to me, what I found that I think works really well is we're not a sales driven company or an engineering driven company. Usually companies are one of the two. To me, it's, hey, we're a people driven company. Everybody is on the same level. Like we don't give salespeople different hours because they're salespeople, or engineers different hours because they're engineers. Like to me, it creates, I think, undue animosity. And for me, it's, hey, everyone here is equally important. We're all serving the same purpose of, you know, generating, helping, you know, millions of companies, you know, millions of people share millions of companies, right? And generating word of mouth across the world. So this is something that everybody is an equal stakeholder in.
So I saw an example of what happens when you're not communicating this stuff well. Do you have an example of how culture helped your business in a way that was how culture helped your business? I'll end the question there.
Yeah, I mean, so it's helped immensely. So I would say obsess about culture, but I think what's fantastic is we've created what I would say is amazing culture. We've won like local business awards. We're in like the top, I think, number 3 out of 100. We're like a 4.8 on Glassdoor. And what it allows for us to do, to be honest, is it's a competitive advantage. And, you know, our culture isn't for everybody, certainly. I mean, I think we try really hard. We have amazing, talented people. But where it's helps the businesses. When someone moves to Detroit, the Detroit area, from anywhere else in the country, they're coming to us first.
You're saying it helps you bring in really good people. Okay, once they're in, how does culture help the way that they work? What's an example of that?
So I think, you know, I think one way that helps them work, one of our habits is raise the bar. So I think everybody, you know, coming in, raising the bar or choosing camaraderie. I mean, very often I spend time with each person on their first day. I go through kind of our values, and then I check in with them, you know, over the course of the first few months, you know, more than even normal. And the feedback that I consistently get is, this is the nicest group of people I've ever been around. And it was a conscious decision. We decided that we're not going to hire what, you know, some of us here, we're no brilliant assholes, right? Like, that's a conscious decision for us. Is we're going to hire good people and create an environment that people enjoy first and foremost. And they have to have all the other tangibles too.
You've also let go of people who were good performers but didn't fit culturally. Can you give me an example? I obviously don't want specifics, but give me an example of that.
Yeah, so I mean, it's unfortunate. We multiple times have had high performing employees who have technically done the things they're supposed to do and even exceeded expectations. And when people start to give them kind of a Venn diagram where there's two circles. One is the results, like the technical results of the tasks you're doing, and the second is your personality, right? And that matters, right? Like the way that you treat people, the way that you treat customers, and they're equally weighted. And a lot of people are like, well, I just want to be measured on results. And I'm like, yeah, well, the results are this complete circle, but half of the results are the way you treat people. And so that for us, you know, when you have one person that's a disruptor or causing friction amongst the team, it affects, you know, it multiplies, right? Just as a positive or contagiously positive person can bring everybody up, a negative person can bring everybody down. And so we made a conscious decision to say, we let someone go. And I was super nervous to tell the team that we let someone go because it's going to be more work for everybody. And that's, you know, one of these people, you know, they took a ton of work from other folks. And we told them, we said, listen, you know, unfortunately, they're not going to be here anymore. And for us, it was like, we really wanted to stick with our values, and we know there's been some issues, and, you know, we're going to make hiring and firing promotion decisions based on these values, even if sometimes it sets us back in the short term. And after I did that, and this was actually great advice from our investors, they said, your team will actually support you and rally around it. And they did. I got a lot of private emails that said, hey, we really respect that. We know it's going to be painful. Like, what can I do to help? And it was really cool. I mean, it was one of the really cool moments of being really terrified to announce this decision and get great feedback from the team.
You mentioned onboarding a little bit. Why don't we close out with that? You told our producer I was naive about onboarding employees. What's the onboarding naivete that you had, and what are you doing now?
So now we have a pretty, and again, formal is all relative, but we used to hire somebody and put them in a chair and kind of say, this is your job, you know, figure it out, right? Now it's we have a pretty formal process. The first 2 weeks are pretty structured, from meeting with various departments, understanding kind of at a broad level what each department does and what people do. But most importantly is really indoctrinating them with the values and the expectations from the beginning. And again, the biggest learning that I have from going from a team where I was at the table and everyone knew how we operated because I was there, you know, in the trenches with them, is now when you have, you know, dozens of tables and dozens of teams, you have people that are not sure how to act in certain situations and not sure how to, you know, take this kind of feedback or this kind of feedback. So we just make it really clear for them. And I say, listen, we're going to be here for you. You can come to me directly with any problems.
What's the process for onboarding?
So in terms of like the actual,
I guess, where do you set up the process, and then what's special about it that you're especially proud of?
So it's a series of tools, to be honest. Some of it's in Google Docs. Some of it is, we have a, like an LMS or like a learning management system where people go in and actually take quizzes and learn things.
Really?
Presentation that I give on the first day. And then there's a series of individual presentations by the various department heads. So all of those things are happening kind of in harmony. There's homework the person has. We have like day zero. So like your McKinsey consultant,
yeah,
you know, we have kind of pre-work that, you know, that we ask them to do. And it's not much, but it's, again, getting them into the kind of understanding how we operate. And I think opening up the dialogue, becoming, letting them know that transparency and encouraging feedback is the utmost importance for us is huge. And I think when I can do that face to face with the person their first day, they're typically pretty nervous. They don't know what to expect from me. What I found is the people that I've actually done this with, which is, let's say, half the team, some of them were here before we started doing this, they tend to be a lot more open, a lot more transparent, give a lot better feedback to us, and then we can therefore make it better for the next person. And, you know, we've always wanted that stuff, but until we kind of formalized it, we weren't getting the feedback quick enough, right? Or we were getting it when things were really, really bad or really good. Now we're getting it in a much more consistent, in a consistent way.
All right. If you see me looking all over the screen, it's when you mention something, I have to go look at it. So when you said 4.8 on Glassdoor, I said, that doesn't seem right. How do you get 4.8 on Glassdoor? That's a place where people go and bitch. Yeah. That's where I get like some of my best material about the founder or CEO, because it goes in there when people leave. That's when they get like insulting in some ways. No, you have 94% would recommend to a friend, 4.8 approval rating on Glassdoor for the whole company, and 94% approve of the CEO. That's you, Jeff.
It's cool. That's
phenomenal. I see a bunch of pictures on there too. All right. Anyone wants to go check out the site? It is getambassador.com. Getambassador.com. Is that a place also where anyone could create an affiliate program if they want to, or an influencer program to reward influencers and help influencers get money when, or get paid when they're spreading the word, right?
Exactly. Any company that's looking to acquire customers, I mean, again, it is obviously a little bit, you know, it's, you know, mid-market and above in terms of up from a price point perspective, but it's absolutely something where companies are looking to invest in scaling their customer acquisition. You know, we're happy to talk to them and help them out.
All right. And the two sponsors that I mentioned, and I will ask you about what that backdrop is in a second. The two sponsors are the company that we use to create sales, to build a sales machine. It's called Pipedrive. It'll kind of force you to do it. They're kind of jerks about it, that you can't just willy-nilly add contacts into their system. They insist that you actually have a structured way of closing sales. Go sign up, pipedrive.com/mixergy. And the second is a company that I've heard hired a developer from, a designer from, and now my new consultant from previously from McKinsey to help me with the profitability of our business. It is called Top Tal. Top is in top of your head. Tal is in talent. TOPTAL.com/mixergy. And one last thing, our team is kind of messing around with the audio a little bit to try to improve it, messing around with the video to try to improve that. Give us feedback. Let them know how they're doing by just emailing them contact@mixergy.com. The whole team will see it and they'll know whether they're doing a good job or not. Close it out for us, Jeff. What's in the background?
Yeah, so the background is Shire. So one of the things as we grow and try to make things more fun, it's all of our conference rooms have various murals on it. So this one, if you can see it here, it's actually, I believe it's the Shire, and you know, we're big Lord of the Rings fans. I'm a big movie fan. So we have Temple of Doom, Gotham City,
the Matrix. Gotham City would have Gotham behind you if you were sitting in it.
Yeah.
It's a really good backdrop. And also, I've got to tell you, the lighting is really good. It's very hard for an entrepreneur to find a good quiet spot to go do an interview like this. Can you turn the camera around so we can see what you're looking at?
Sure. So this is it's the big mural.
Yes.
Back.
What's in front of it? What were you facing? It looks like you're on a laptop.
I'm facing a whiteboard, so it's pretty boring on this side. So.
The room looks so gigantic.
Yeah, this is a big room. It worked well. I tried to get good lighting and good acoustics. So this is and good internet. So this is one of the rooms we can plug in. So
one of the things that I like about you is like this attention to detail. All right. Congratulations on the business, guys. Go check them out at getambassador.com. Thanks.
Thanks, Andrew. Bye-bye.